The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, so the two primary texts that I use for my lead aren't at Haymarket Books, so I'm just going to say them for you all to write them down really quick. The first one is Hebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities by Craig Wilder. The second is Indian Education in the American Colonies, 1607 to 1783 by Margaret Connell Saz. So by the early 1600s, when the first settlement of Jamestown was established, Britain had already been a leading European power through its participation in the transatlantic slave trade, in the Christian Crusades against the Muslims, its colonization of Ireland, as just some examples of its imperialist project aimed at trying to build a colonial empire. A class of wealthy merchants in Britain were coming together to find opportunities to expand their wealth, and they had established companies that they had hoped would profit from the new world, as did the other European powers. One such company was the Virginia Company of London, who were given the okay and the authority by King James I to settle in Virginia for the purposes of expanding the reach of the British Empire. When the first ship of over 100 Englishmen arrived and established what they called Jamestown, they encountered the Powhatan indigenous peoples, a network of about 30 Algonquin-speaking tribes that had united under the leadership of Wahansinakowa as a response to Spanish colonists who had driven them north to the area that we now refer to as Virginia. The Powhatan responded with heroic displays of resistance against the efforts to establish settlements by the early English colonists in Virginia. The resistance had led to a series of what were called the Anglo-Powhatan Wars that took place from 1610 to 1646. In the aftermath of the first Anglo-Powhatan War, which ended in 1614, that had really demonstrated to the English colonists and the Virginia Company of London the scale of resistance from the indigenous population to their project of settler colonialism, which meant that they needed to rethink or at least change some aspects of the strategy if they were going to gain the upper hand. Thus, 1 year after the first Anglo-Powhatan War in 1615, the Virginia Company of London decided to shift its base of operations from Jamestown to a second settlement that they called Enriquez near what we refer to as Richmond, Virginia. King James I directed his bishops to hold collections for, quote, the founding and endowing of an ample college to be erected in Virginia amongst those barbarians, end quote. This college was slated to be called Enrico College, and the Virginia Company of London, which had put forth a significant portion of the funding for the project, established its vision for the college in its 1618 charter, which they wrote, quote, a college for the training up of the children of those infidels in true religion, moral virtue, and civility, and other forms of godliness, end quote. Part of Enrico College would include the East India School, whose purposes was to prepare English students to attend Enrico College, as well as introduce young indigenous boys, both kidnapped and enslaved, to learn Christianity. The King of England had requested education for the natives, but on the premise that if you make them Christian, that somehow makes them more civilized. Strategically, colonists believed that education of a few indigenous people into Christianity, as well as English, Latin, and Greek, was a key entry point into the conversion of all indigenous peoples to obtain more indentured labor, gain an upper hand in military strategy, and ultimately conquer them. By 1619, supporters for the college had raised thousands in Britain for the colonial school. They collected donations for a library. Only the first enslaved Africans had begun to be traded in the colony, so they had acquired mostly a few hundred indentured servants to construct the college, which included about 50 Christian missionaries tasked with, quote, the reclaiming of the Paris natives, end quote. A few years into the construction of Enrico College and after the first major Anglo-Powhatan War, the Powhatan indigenous people had caught on to the strategy of the colonists to expand their settlements, to establish the college, and decided to organize a surprise attack, killing colonists, destroying their settlements, including Enrico College, before it could open its doors, which would have been the first institution of higher education in the U.S. The attempt to establish Enrico College and the East India School demonstrated the first two primary functions of higher education institutions in the colonial era. The first, to establish a system of education for colonists that required the learning of Latin and Greek as a way to maintain power and status in colonial society over other Europeans like indentured servants and others who worked the tobacco fields. Second, the attempt to Christianize indigenous peoples as part of a wider strategy to protect and expand the project of settler colonialism. Karl Marx's version of this function, I guess you could say, is laid out in the German ideology to some extent when he writes, quote, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. The class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production, so that thereby, generally speaking, the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are subject to it, end quote. The ruling material force in this case was the British Empire. In Wilder's book, Ebony and Ivory, he says, quote, universities facilitated England's colonial campaigns in Scotland and Ireland, and they played a similar role in the Americas. The eradication of the indigenous population, their way of life, the theft of land, was part of the emergence of capitalism. As Karl Marx writes in Capital, Volume 1, the transformation of the individualized and scattered means of production into socially concentrated ones, of the pygmy property of the many into the huge property of the few, the expropriation of the great mass of people from the soil, from the means of subsistence, from the means of labor. This fearful and painful expropriation of the mass of people forms the prelude to the history of capital. So, knowing the power that universities can play in expanding their project of settler colonialism, the colonists did not want to give up. Instead, Harvard became the second attempt by colonists to establish an institution of higher education for the purposes of Christianizing the native population as one key component, which was much further away from the threat that the Powhatan Indians had posed in Virginia. In 1643, a group of colonists across Plymouth and the Massachusetts Bay Colonies wrote a pamphlet titled New England's First Fruit, where they essentially described their vision for what it meant to convert indigenous peoples to Christianity and civility. Because apparently they weren't doing this in establishing the colonies, and the King of England was upset that, like, what are you all doing over there? You're not attempting to Christianize the native. What's up with that? So they needed to produce this pamphlet, which was essentially a call for others to financially support Harvard College. It was a call put out to really the Christian missionaries that they could come to the colonies and be supported in their process of converting the converting the native people. Now, the native population often resisted attempts to be Christianized, but free room and board offered by the missionaries meant that natives could escape the violent genocidal impact of settler colonialism. Harvard's first president, Henry Dunster, an experienced missionary himself, encouraged Indian education and expanded the charter to include the evangelization of native people. He laid the foundation for a specific Indian college within Harvard that was taken up by his successor, Charles Chauncey, who finally opened the Indian College in the late 1650s. And it was the first brick structure in Harvard Yard, a two-story building next to the president's house. It had room for studying, instruction, and it would house about 20 students. It offered free education to Indians and encouraged their English students to learn Algonquin. Harvard's Indian students were, in the words of its first graduate, Chesahatakamanak, quote, instruments to spread and propagate the gospel among our kin, our neighbors, so that they may know the Lord and Christ, end quote. Some of them lived amongst the colonists to serve as translators for the English to gain an upper hand over the native population in their expansion of settler colonialism. This would prove to be especially helpful leading up to King Philip's War in 1965, in which Indian graduates of Harvard became friends of Chief Metacomet of the Wampanoag people, who would later reveal his plan to attack the English colonists to the English colonists. The success of to establish Harvard kind of set a precedent for some of the other colonial colleges in this period. Meanwhile, back in Virginia, a second and third Anglo-Powhatan War had broken out, which tilted the balance of class forces in favor of the indigenous people. They had been attacking frontier settlements, and Governor William Berkeley, out of fear, refused to organize a retaliation against the native population for fear that they would win. This pushed the colonial elite to establish a multi-pronged strategy. The first is they revisited the goal of erecting a college for the education of the natives in Virginia 70 years later after the destruction of Enrico College, and this is the College of William and Mary, and it was established in 1693 with the goal of civilizing and Christianizing the natives as an integral part of its mission. Second, passing the Virginia Slave Codes of 1705 that would mark black skin for inferiority as a divide and conquer tactic, which meant that blacks were prevented from any forms of education at all whatsoever. They weren't allowed to learn how to read or write or any of that stuff. And third, the maintenance and expansion of chattel slavery. At a certain historical point, black slave labor replaced indentured servitude as the dominant form of labor used by the colonists. This meant that slave labor was absolutely essential to the physical construction and the maintenance of the early colonial colleges. John Winthrop, a leading figure of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, has sent his nephew, George Dowling, to attend Harvard, and he became part of its first graduating class. Wilder notes that he, quote, spent months preaching to the English in Barbados, Antigua, Santa Cruz, Nevis, and St. Christopher, where he measured the demand for New England commodities and gathered advice on establishing slavery in the Puritan colonies. He explained that newcomers used English indentured servants until they could afford to procure Negroes, the life of this place. The plantations were so profitable that an enslaved African paid for himself or herself only after 18 months. The Puritans quickly adopted slaveholding, end quote. For the purpose of the time, I'm just gonna quickly say that presidents of colonial colleges would use slaves to construct and work on the campus. Their labor as cooks, servants, caretakers, field workers were indispensable for these institutions to run. At certain points, the amount of slaves that would be brought on campus would equal or even outnumber the students that were enrolled. College administrators prioritize bringing slaveholding elite to be educated on their campus so that they can give back to the institution through wealth that they would generate from slavery, which we can argue that Harvard's extensive endowment today has its roots in settler colonialism and in the enslavement of the black population. So really the first colonial colleges were essential to the maintenance of both the African slave trade and slavery and the settler colonialism against indigenous population. I'll skip my Karl Marx quote on how these two systems are what he says the chief momentum of primitive accumulation. So you lead up into the American Revolution. A lot of these colleges that I'm talking about are today's Ivy Leagues: Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, University of Pennsylvania, Brown, and Dartmouth, which is, I think it's great to see some of the struggles, particularly by black students in a lot of these colleges, that force the administration to acknowledge and to recognize the legacies of slavery and settler colonialism that are still present and visible on today's college campuses. Following the American Revolution, Thomas Jefferson, considered, you know, an American founding father, key author of the Declaration of Independence, born and educated in colonial Virginia, graduated from the College of William and Mary. He was responsible for really the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, a deal that allowed him to purchase a massive plot of land from France, which at the time almost doubled the size of the U.S. The purchase of more land meant that the project of settler colonialism and slavery could be expanded westward as a precondition for the expansion of higher ed. The Louisiana Purchase was followed by the Indian Removal Act of 1830. The theft of indigenous people's land was essential to the expansion of higher education in this period, so that they can grow well beyond the 9 colonial colleges that existed. According to Robert Thalen, who's a major historian of higher education, he writes of this period, quote, "Higher education would become America's cottage industry. In 1800, there were 25 degree-granting colleges in the U.S. By 1820, the number had increased to 52. This was steady and substantial proliferation, but it would be dwarfed by the college building boom of the next 3 decades, which by 1860 brought the total number to 241, which does not include the 40 colleges that had been founded but had ceased operation. So after the Louisiana Purchase, the Indian Removal Act, but before the Civil War, colleges and universities really grew from about 52 to 241. In this period, it was no longer the colonial elite who were being educated, but there was others like the sons of farmers who had begun to attend college. Colleges expanded their instruction and curriculum to include agriculture, science, law, engineering, commerce. It was in this period that a famous report called the Yale Report of 1828 was published, which the faculty at Yale College defended the classical curriculum of Latin and Greek, which they viewed as essential, but in other educational institutions, they viewed that as obsolete or dead or whatever. The authority of this report, I mean, they asserted in the famous statement in the document, quote, "The two great points to be gained by an intellectual culture are the discipline and furniture of the mind, expanding its powers and storing it with knowledge." The authority of this document did carry through to the colonial college and lasted through the first Civil War and the enactment of the first Morrill Act of 1862, which created land-grant colleges. While not calling for the exclusion of classical studies, the Morrill Land Grant Act had focused on agricultural and mechanical arts, which moved the purposes of higher education in a slightly different direction. So we begin to see, really, first, the social reproduction of labor power at a certain point in the expansion westward. It became important to educate farmers, people that would work the land, who then eventually, through the rise of industry, would sell themselves off to growing capitalist industries. Another example of this process was the integrated forced labor that now became an essential feature of Indian education. So now Indian students or indigenous people who were attending these colleges were now forced to work within and outside school hours and were taught to, quote, be taught to work like the white man. This key function of higher education would expand much later in the 1920s and 60s because the number of people attending colleges at this time was still very tiny, but it's important to note that the changing modes and relations of production in the North pushed higher education to think about how is it going to meet the needs of its laboring workforce. Second, it was not just about learning Latin and Greek, but also an anti-black racist ideology and white supremacist ideology as two fundamental forms of ruling class ideology. In his book, Ebony and Ivy, Wilder talks a lot about how the professors at these colleges eventually went on to talk about black skin inferiority, scientific research, biological supremacy of the white race, and how all these things were essential to the curriculum that were integrated later. College graduates from schools, from universities in the North would go on to kind of apprentice under some of the slave traders that were all in New England, the Mid-Atlantic, and Europe. They traveled to the South and West Indies, teachers, educators, all this stuff. But it demonstrated that even though the North was beginning to phase out slavery, its graduates would go on to generate wealth on cotton plantations in order to fund and expand their alma maters in the North. So, all right, I gotta hurry this up. All of these changes, the changes around the primitive accumulation of capital, settler colonialism, racism, white supremacy, reproduction of labor power, led to a groundswell of activity on college campuses in the form of resistance. Anti-slavery societies emerged all throughout this period, especially in the colleges in the North. As many as 20 abolitionist societies had formed from New England to Illinois, one of the largest being at Amherst College, which established 78 members, a lot of them who were the college's poorest students. Students organized protests, circulated petitions, spoke on anti-slavery both in and outside the college, and it began to really stoke fear in the administration of the colleges and the surrounding people. In 1831, 30 years before the Civil War, a coalition comprised of freed black men convened in the first annual convention of people of color in the city of Philadelphia, whose agenda included a plan to petition the government of New Haven, Connecticut, to establish a college for, quote, the liberal education of young men of color on the system of manual labor, by which in connection with a scientific education may also obtain a useful mechanical or agricultural profession, end quote. The black men at the convention hoped to gain support from some of these abolitionist society in their proposal for the college, especially since some of these white poor students themselves were being educated for the same purposes of mechanical arts and agriculture. I'm just gonna quickly quote something else. He says, as the number of poor students rose, both Harvard and Yale found it more difficult to maintain the college commons. Disputes over food in the commons came to represent more frivolous complaints, or more than frivolous complaints. They were economic wrangles between social classes over the style of student life. They disrupted the old arrangements of dining. The period leading up to the Civil War demonstrated the earliest forms of student resistance, which begins to show us how higher education institutions become a contested political terrain upon which capitalism, racism, and other systems of oppression are not only reproduced, but also can be challenged depending on our ability as organizers to push out onto the scene. I'm gonna end on a couple things I want to say around after the Civil War. Really, the end of chattel slavery dealt a blow to the idea of racism and white supremacy, but the ruling class understood the centrality of these tools to divide and conquer people. So really, throughout this period, universities and colleges were essential to the ratcheting up and the development of sciences, and particular the eugenics movement, to reassert this idea of black skin inferiority and white skin superiority. These also had implications for people with disabilities who were also seen as inferior, women, LGBTQ people, and really universities and colleges were essential to that research that was being produced at the time. Now, leading up, and I'll end on this, I promise, I'm almost done, because I have to skip over a lot, but really I think what I wanted to mention here is there's this book called When the Old Left Was Young by Cohen, where he talks about the student resistance. Now that they began to accept more poor students, the Great Depression had dramatically impacted students at these colleges, and they began to organize massive student revolts. As high as 50% of the student population at that time was fighting against not just poverty, but also the U.S. beginning to enter into World War I. And certainly, once the U.S. came out of the first two world wars, it made a big push to establish research for the founding of like the National Science Foundation, pumping millions and millions of dollars to research universities, because it understood that in order to emerge as the global super imperial power, that universities would have to be essential to not only the development of eugenics, but the type of research that would allow them to gain a stockpile of nuclear weapons to gain, to really serve as the imperial power in the world. And I just want to end on, again, I think reasserting that as oppressive and exploitative as colleges and universities can be, it really is up to us as socialists, as radicals, to really cohere ourselves into student organizations, into coalitions, as branches of the ISO, to really recount this history, to read about it and to learn about it, and to understand how oppressed students who are subjected to oppression must be at the center of the fight for a different type of higher education, one that meets the needs of the vast majority of people, and one that is can seem really far away, but that is worth throwing ourselves into. And I think it begins at conferences like this.
Hi everyone, how are you doing?
Great.
Excellent, hope you're enjoying the talk so far. I'm just here to report that I was looking at Fermin's scroll bar. He was by no means actually almost done. There was so much to say. I think that either of the focuses of our talks could deserve their own session entirely, but sort of had to squeeze them into this one. So that being said, I'm gonna present sort of a really broad brushstrokes, history of the development of higher education, sort of World War II, Cold War, and beyond up until now. And I'm just gonna preface that I'm not gonna be able to get into a lot of really detailed examples, so I hope that you will bring them up in the discussion. So, the time period that I'm talking about is a lot more condensed than the historical expanse that Fermin just covered, but a lot has happened in the past 70 years to change the structure of higher education. Following World War II, colleges and universities became key institutions of American society, second only in importance to private corporations and the military. Indeed, universities became closely tied to big business, especially through the research sponsored by private foundations. At the same time, their ties to the military and the CIA made them into virtual instruments of the US state. In the Gramscian sense, they became part of the non-coercive state apparatus, although it's debatable the extent to which a system that restricts your opportunities for employment based on either holding that college degree or doing the research that has funding attached to it is non-coercive. Particularly when backed with the legitimacy and authority of the US federal policy and money. To understand the evolving dynamic between the development of capitalism and the resultant shifts in education, we have to critically investigate their connection with the evolving capitalist political economy of the United States post-1945. And I also wanna just say right now that my intent is not to badmouth anything that we've done. Academically speaking, in terms of technological development, things like that, we've made great strides. We've had impressive growth in higher education, the massification of it, and I think that we would all agree that having more people with access to education is good. Even if the instruments used to get us there weren't serving the interests of the people, right? Over this period, the U.S. higher education system grew by leaps and bounds, adjusting to support the mass influx of students who would go on to become the intelligentsia and the skilled workers that we have in society. And we've seen absolutely astounding technological and theoretical advancements, and the wealth generated by American capitalism provided the material foundation for the achievements of American higher learning during this period, but it's also responsible for some of its limitations. These limits took the forms of consistent bias in research and teaching against Marxism, and indeed against a historically based understanding of culture and society in favor of defending liberalism, capitalism, and American imperialism. So we sort of were asking, you know, Marx has the quote about the ruling class having the ruling ideas being that of the ruling class, but we have to ask ourselves, how are those ruling ideas created and propagated? That's higher ed. But it was this ideological program of defending liberalism, capitalism, and imperialism that unified the humanities and social sciences during this post-World War II period in the beginning of the Cold War. The student and civil rights revolts of the 1960s briefly helped to expose the ideological functions of higher education, but did not fundamentally transform them. Charting the development of academia will illuminate the economic, social, and ideological functions of the university. It's important because universities have reached a major crossroads and their future prospects are in serious doubt. So we have to really ask ourselves, can higher ed continue in this mode that it's been operating in? I'm gonna skip ahead just a bit. Fermin talked about all the capitalist history of higher ed in the US prior to the World War II era and the beginning of the Cold War, and I'm gonna transition us now to talking since then, and I'm gonna offer up a two-part model of influence that I think is occurring, and I'm going to be drawing on some of the work, the Giroux neoliberalism, the neoliberalism in higher ed, but also the Cold War and the university toward an intellectual history of the post-war years. It's an edited volume that I would recommend. And then most notably, the capitalist university transformations in higher education since 1945 by Henry Heller. Definitely recommend you check that out in the Haymarket Room. The two-part model of influence that I'm sort of advocating for is this more traditional one that we understand of the direct economics. We are changing the structure by having more bloated administrations. There's direct monetary influence over the direction of research and such like that. But I also want to, and Henry Heller really gets at some of the intricacy and intricate details of how this is happening, but that it's not just the structures, but it's the content, it's the actual ideas, it's the how we're framing problems in order to reach solutions. And let me tell you, they're not premised off of people. They're not premised off of the motives of actually making lives better for anyone. So let's set the stage for what this period of growth and development sort of looked like. American isolationism was coming to a crashing end and being replaced by the development of US hegemony politically, economically, and militarily in the world. And as the US was emerging as this new superpower, the American ruling class via the state recognized that it really didn't have the dedicated scholarship, deep bodies of knowledge, or expertise that disciplinary study provides to really carry out its agenda. It didn't have the type of people in academia that had deep knowledge of different areas or foreign language skill or anything that you might need if you wanted to, I don't know, go do regime change in another country. And so what did it do? This is sort of reflected in how the disciplines are thinking of themselves and thinking of their future scholarship. In 1943, the Committee on World Regions of the Social Science Research Council, which is the coordinating council of the seven major U.S. social science national associations, wrote a report titled World Regions in the Social Sciences. The report is very clear about the impact that World War II was having on the direction of the research agenda for the field, and I think it's worth reading a little bit of a longer quote, only because it's illustrative of the point. The present war has focused attention as never before upon the entire world. Interest in foreign regions has been intensified and sharp attention drawn to areas over which we have felt little or no concern. Self-reflexive. The immediate need for social scientists who know the different regions of the world stands second only to the demand for military and naval officers familiar with the actual and potential combat zones. Like, that's how serious they saw their project. Since few overseas areas have hitherto attracted research, we lack the regional knowledge now required, and traditional curricula and methods of instruction have left inert much of the information that we do possess. Travel and individual study have supplemented formal training but failed to correct the deficiency, and immigrants have learned more from us than we from them. The consequent scarcity of professional and scientific personnel, combining linguistic and regional knowledge with technical proficiency, seriously hampers every war agency. And this is not the Department of Defense speaking. This is like an independent body of supposed social scientists. Our need for a comprehensive knowledge of other lands will not end with the armistice or reconstruction. No matter what shape international organization may assume, the United States will enjoy unexampled opportunities and face heavy responsibilities. Yikes. There's a lot to unpack there. I mean, clearly there's racism, xenophobia, imperialism, a colonial mindset that is really underlying all of the research agenda for social sciences in this period. And that sets the stage for how you, for a lot of things that I can't really get into now. And so then we see, what did the state do to address this deficit that it saw, this lack of knowledge? The GI Bill passed in 1944, the government sought to inject a cohort of people being trained with those particular skills. It sought to massify higher education by turning soldiers into the intelligentsia with that knowledge that they could then use to go back into soldiery, basically. The government subsequently also poured money into government agencies such as the National Science Foundation, not to mention the CIA, which provides a lot of research funding sort of independently of defense, but is one of the major ways that sort of research dollars are attached to a particular agenda for inquiry. Right now, the NSF is currently funding research into 10 big ideas, exploring things such as the future of work, human technology frontier, and new applications for big data, which we all sort of know what that looks like with ICE databases. Like, that's their future for big data. And pushing an agenda focused on workforce development through technological literacy without acknowledging all the ways that capitalism actually makes deep knowledge not only impossible but undesirable for the same people that they're trying to get to learn how to code. Thanks. Crap. In 1957, Russians launched Sputnik, which caused panic among those who were working to enshrine American preeminence, and one response was the signing of the National Defense Education Act the very next year in 1958. Coincidentally, this is what grants the government to, the authority to provide student loans for undergraduate and graduate study. Thanks a lot. But it also explicitly tied the federal role in education to that to the project of defense, from creating foundations for the foundations for like assessment and rigorous use of metrics, to providing funds for training graduate students and building the ranks of faculty working and thinking on war-based projects. We have to understand that this wasn't like that. This was the goal. Like, that's what the National Defense Education Act was supposed to do. It provided training in foreign languages, except the dead languages, because they only wanted the ones that you could actually use to go communicate with the people that you're trying to overthrow. That's it. I mean, it's pretty naked self-interest. And we have to really understand that this wasn't a covert goal of the governments, but an overt one that really fit in with the zeitgeist of the time. McCarthyism was in full force, and academics, in order to receive that influx of new federal money, and to keep their jobs, were forced to sign loyalty oaths. They were forced to pursue research agendas that were tied to the money that was existing. And faculty members suspected of communist sympathies were routinely dismissed without cause and blacklisted from the university. So it was a real, like, Marxism, you don't talk about it, and you sort of go along to go along. Would definitely recommend, if you want to like hear more of an insider's perspective on that, this one, The Cold War and the University. It sort of taught, it is their personal reflections of going through this time period and watching their own disciplines evolve from the inside. Fascinating stuff. There is a deep ahistorical and positivist bent to inquiry across a range of disciplines. In the words of Vannevar Bush, science, and indeed all of inquiry, was the endless frontier. And for a deep discussion of those trends, definitely read Henry Heller's book. And I'm gonna make a shameless plug to read my forthcoming review in the fall ISR. Plug that ISR. This dynamic spurred the U.S. federal government to pour money into the STEM fields in addition to laying the material foundation for the creation of new disciplines such as area studies, which didn't exist until then. The U.S. saw the opportunity to harness the expertise of researchers and scientists to meet their own needs for a dedicated body of war researchers. We can't forget that these endeavors inevitably come home to roost, with the rise of scientific crowd control techniques as an example of the way that this knowledge is used to suppress resistance here. They try that out, like, in other countries, and then they bring that sort of crowd control stuff home, psychological tactics of warfare and things like that. We often like see the capture of scientific research agenda and the hard sciences and material sciences like that. That I see is often held up as the most common examples of ways that the federal government is interjecting itself. But a really key argument is that of the social sciences, the ideologies that sort of surround us that we're all living in, and that's the social sciences and the humanities. Henry Heller, in his book, describes the process by which area studies rose to allow for the federal government to develop that deep knowledge about a particular region, focusing on events, focusing on particular historical events, leading to an analysis of their current situations for the purposes of intervention and control. Heller notes that the process that the field of economics went through as well to shed itself of its historical and political considerations in favor of a quantitative approach based on the aggregate of consumer preferences and an idealized understanding of market functions. The goal of removing history and politics was nothing less than reducing capitalism to a solvable function, denying its inherent instability and propensity for crisis. Heller writes, in its very method, it sought to deny the volatility of a system whose progress had been based on repeated economic and political crises. And by reducing capitalism to a mathematical function or just another social science problem to solve, you deny the role of class in shaping economic life and forego the need for mass mobilization and action to make change in the underlying system. You see similar trends across other disciplines like geography, geology, history, and various languages. Again, in 1943, responding to national and international political events, both the SSRC, the Social Science Research Council, and Columbia University Joint Committee on Graduate Instruction designated Latin America, China, and Japan as the top priority for study in this new discipline that was emerging, requiring the most urgent investment. This, of course, mirrored the focus of the US government's aims for intervention and reflected the anxieties of the US ruling class. But we can trace this parallel development of American imperialism and American structures of higher ed. One way is to look at where faculty members are, who are staffing the offices within the federal government. We see a revolving door between department chairs, center directors, and research positions, just like we see a revolving door between industry, lobbying bodies, and government cabinet positions today. In 1965, speaking of the related field to area studies, international relations, the president of the International Studies Association, John Gange, recalled that the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA, was like a big university faculty in many respects. Sometimes staff meetings were just like faculty meetings. I mean, that's how closely these things were intertwined. And people are sort of fine with that, you know? The vast majority of people during that time bought into that sort of program, and they support Americans taking on its leadership role in the world and maintaining its own dominance. And we saw that it's only when that facade began to crumble in the 1970s with the collapse of Keynesian economic interventions and the rise of stagflation that it presented a serious challenge to our economic supremacy, and we saw a renewed vigor for protesting, and that's in the late 60s when it's starting to crumble, and then into the 70s. The anti-war movement, free speech movements, black power movements, burgeoning women's rights and gay liberation movements provided glimmers of hope and demonstrated that the university was an ideological space that had a role within the capitalist system to educate workers, to reproduce ideology, and to act as the point of production for many particular innovations. Students and faculty members were sitting in, speaking out, taking over their campuses. In October of 1966, Students for a Democratic Society counted 25,000 members, having mushroomed from 2,500 only 2 years before. They eventually had a final cap of 100,000 members once belonged to Students for a Democratic Society, but that was shortly before it collapsed. Students were integrating lunch counters, buses, their own schools. They were challenging outdated and paternalistic systems of campus governance, demanding a more democratic voice in the running of their institutions. In the fall of 1968, more than 350,000 students said they strongly agreed with the statement that some form of mass revolutionary party was needed in America. According to one poll in 1969, more than 1 million students considered themselves revolutionaries or socialists of some kind or another. By then, more than 300 out of the 2,000 campuses had experienced sit-ins, building takeovers, riots, and strikes. Between January of 69 and April of 1970, young radicals bombed hundreds of police stations, corporate offices, military facilities, ROTC buildings, and 26,000 out of a total population of 10 million college students had been arrested. What a time to be alive. This was a period when the complicity of the academy and post-war imperialism of the US was being challenged by student protests and a resurgence of Marxist scholarship. What was once with McCarthyism, sort of Marxist scholars were blacklisted, pushed out, isolated, now it was becoming in vogue again to actually talk about Marx in your analysis. It was really an amazing sort of resurgence. And it represented nothing less than the battle over the purpose of knowledge. In the turbulent period was touched off by civil rights movement and then followed quickly by the free speech movement. Students at UC Berkeley recognized the increasingly corporatist bent of their academic administration and rebelled against the paternalistic curtailment of their ability to speak out and table for political issues going on in the world. Central to student rebellion was the mass rejection of the Vietnam War and a focus on free speech. These were really amazing struggles for us to look back for and lessons in our own organizing today, and they did win real forms. So the rise of Black studies, women and gender studies, Chicano studies, getting rid of the in loco parentis model of student affairs. These are all wonderful steps in the right direction that we should fight to maintain and support. But many of these reforms have since been rolled back. Students themselves are increasingly squeezed within a neoliberal world order. They're forced to adapt to the individualistic, competitive approach to education that capitalism demands, and they become compliant. They study business and economics and eschewing humanities and social sciences while focusing on earning a degree that they have been told will grant them some modicum of stability in an economy that is not designed to support them.
Yes.
But there's a lesson that we need to really learn from that experience, and that is capitalism is a wily bastard. And it is adaptable enough to incorporate these kinds of challenges while still maintaining its core dynamic and its power. So these departments, they become subject to the institutionalized rules and methods of organizing within a university. The university was now able to control the budget for those departments and to monitor its content, the kind of scholarship that's getting produced. As Henry Heller notes, the student and civil rights revolts of the 60s briefly helped to expose the ideological functions of higher ed, but did not fundamentally transform them. So then we're moving on to neoliberalism. With the legitimacy of American capitalism having been seriously shaken by the upheaval of the 1960s, we see the capitalist backlash of the neoliberal era. In the academy, the cultural turn and theoretical turn to postmodernism reflected a disillusionment with the possibility of progress through struggle. Academic theory adapted itself to reflect the dominant societal ethos, which was one of a suppressed and defeated left. It is at this point that Heller argues that the academy became complicit with capitalism. Representing nothing less than the negation of history, postmodernism rejected any grand narratives, let alone a Marxist one, questioned the essential knowability of things, and was a reflection of the capitulation to the seeming overwhelming power of the capitalist status quo. Heller admits that postmodernism did serve as a useful corrective to a perhaps too dogmatic or too schematic Marxism, but despite that important contribution, it ultimately provides no theoretical or ideological outlet for change. Heller writes, on the one hand, insofar as postmodernism continues to represent scientific knowledge as absolute knowledge and refuse to see its ongoing negation as part of a historical process, which leads to acceptance of new and partial knowledge, it becomes nihilistic. And then there's neoliberalism, which brings us to present era of academic capitalism that we all know and loathe today. Hallmarks of this period include a corporate university which is marked by declining rates of public funding, bloated administrations receiving salaries that far outpace their actual productivity, increased reliance on contract and adjunct faculty, and a turn toward debt financing, as well as the pursuit of profits through intellectual property, and the exporting of the United States model of higher ed in other countries, which is that lovely soft form of imperialism that we love. The growing international reach of American academe must be understood as just as much an aspect of U.S. imperialism as its military, financial, and economic power overseas. Heller argues that this transformation is itself the result of the intensification of capitalism as well as a reflection of the hegemonic domination of global capitalism in the new millennium. If capital is everywhere, then higher ed must also be everywhere. And if the United States wants to maintain its dominance, then it must also maintain its dominance over the education sphere and which knowledge is getting produced. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to quickly move on to what we can do now. With Trump in office and DeVos at the helm of the Department of Education, we're seeing a dramatic undermining of our hard-won victories. There are no longer federal guidelines for working with transgender students and being able to support them. Guidance for affirmative action and admissions has been rescinded as of a couple of days ago. Student loan options, as absolutely shitty as they are being rolled back, while there are commensurate cuts for grant aid as well, squeezing students more than ever before. Noting the explosive growth of graduate student unions, Heller sees the potential for growth in political and class consciousness among broad layers of students, as well as we can think of adjunct unionization movements happening as well. But we've seen renewed BDS movements take shape, mass protest against racism and police brutality in the wake of the murder of Michael Brown and every other black child that is killed by the police. Outrage over that and continuing scandals of sexual assault on campus, just to name a few. We see the building blocks of radical movements growing on campus. Quick to point out that the growing radicalism among students is being paired with a buildup of the security and police forces on campus as well. Leftist faculty members like Steven Salida are being stifled and punished for expressing their viewpoints and dissent from the existing order. And again, we see the state mobilizing its resources in the name of crushing dissent and imposing ideological control over academia. Though we can all acknowledge the tremendous role that unions could play in constituting the working class as a class in and for itself, we must also recognize the limitations imposed by unions alone. Combining increasing rates of unionization on campus with a broader multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-gender organizing that takes on issues of oppression as well as exploitation is the surest way to link our fight for economic freedom and security with the broader fight for a just society free from all oppression and a higher ed that actually works toward that liberation and towards that just society that we're trying to get to. So since then, we've seen over the past couple of years of the Trump regime continued, if sporadic, protest in what can only be described as a heroic year of couple of years of protest. Campuses have become an even more important battleground against the right and their hateful ideologies. White supremacists are targeting campuses and receiving warm welcome from administrators and trustees in the name of free speech. We have to remember that students were among the millions that marched after Trump's inauguration. Faculty, staff, and students were at airports protesting the Muslim ban. They're saying Me Too. These campuses are places where real struggle is being fought. But an old war rages and a new battle begins, with college campuses being only one site of struggle, albeit an important one. Did I double a paragraph? I did. However, this sort of gets me to, for those of you who are members of the International Socialist Organization, this is why. Like, this whole history of academia being used to justify and provide cover for neoliberal ideology, ruling class ideology, that's why we organize there. Students are fucking powerful, and we have to be there to help them with that multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-gender, like, working class consciousness that we compare with their concentrated location and that student energy and really fight. So as campuses are set to become even more important battlegrounds between the left and the right, as well as between workers and the neoliberal university bosses over the nature and function of higher ed, we must understand the role of the university as a knowledge factory integrated into the capitalist system, and further use that to help guide our efforts to liberate ourselves and our education from the profit motive.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.